We're going to go ahead and call to order because we got Mark Williams with us. He's going to talk to us about agriculture in our area. So we will call the October 6th Environmental Advisory Committee meeting to order. Thanks for everybody for coming. Mark, thanks for being here. We've got Larry Rogers as well. We've got our guest from ESB as well. So we are covered in all the bases. So. Mark, I'll give you the floor.
Very good. I appreciate you having me. Rachel asked me here a couple weeks ago whenever I agreed to do this. Wasn't quite as busy, but it all worked out. So I appreciate this opportunity. I always enjoy talking about agriculture and just near and dear to me. I grew up here in the county, been here for seven generations. My family's always been involved in agriculture, so it's certainly in my blood. But it's an important part of the county, important part of our heritage here, important part of our economy even today, even though we've kind of moved away, you know, and even in terms of generations moving away from the farm, myself included. I'm no longer farming actively. I've got farmland still, got that rented out, but it's that provides some opportunities as well. But I've got a PowerPoint presentation, which I always like pictures because they tell a lot more sometimes than words do. But I've got a bunch, and I'm going to go through them pretty hurriedly. But at any point in time, if there's something that just grabs your attention, you've got questions about, please don't hesitate at all to stop me. I'll start off with kind of an overview, a lot of it more so the makeup of agriculture within the county, the economic impacts that it does have. And then we get toward the end, I'll really touch on how it relates to the environment, stewardship of water, soil, air, and I'll really touch on that particularly for this group, which I think would be more of interest. We began as an organization, we're now a nonprofit, but we started out as a county department, but then set up a nonprofit corporation four years ago. It's worked well. It's a public-private partnership, and it's really an economic development organization is what my role is. That encompasses a lot of different things. We work with some of our public partners. Certainly the county is our main funder and service and provides a big part of our budget. City of Hendersonville works with us, so does Mills River. But the important part is that we do have private members. We're right now at about 52. We've got a big portion of those that make up our board of directors. You have 52 members and 17 board of directors. So the reason it turns out to be that large is because so many people wanted to be on the board. So we accommodated them. And we sometimes have lengthy meetings as a result. So we try to work through that as well. Mission is basically to preserve and grow agriculture and agribusiness. Any business is associated with it. But our focus is on Henderson County. You know, sometimes it will encompass surrounding regions just because you're trying to acquire enough volumes in some cases of a particular commodity. There may be a need for that whenever you're trying to meet certain markets. So we do branch out in some respects. But Henderson County is our main funder, and so Henderson County is our focal point. We talk in terms of farmland preservation from time to time. Our philosophy has been, and one angle is that if we can work with our farmers so that financially it's feasible and profitable to farm, that in and of itself will help in the preservation of farmland. So that's one approach that we do take. Oops. Let's see here. Now, how do I go backwards? Here we go. We try to accomplish our goal several different ways. We've got a multifaceted roles that we play. Supporting and expanding existing operations is one of the key ones. We want to make sure we're taking care of those that are here, folks that have been established, and work with them. Certainly work with new business development. That's the economic development aspect from time to time. We're working with brand new companies coming in looking to locate here. Some things that we do that are a little different than just typical economic development work a lot with establishing new markets and providing new marketing opportunities. And also new growing opportunities. We've seen, just to give an example of that,
I've got a company that I've worked with out of Florida. They were looking to expand production of celery crops. Well, we don't have any celery here, but so we set up some trials, and so we've had them looking at seeing if it'll do well here, and it is. And so next year we'll have a grower that's going to actually produce pretty good volumes of celery. So those are new production opportunities. But you can't, you don't want to grow something if you don't have a market for it. So there's all that has to work together. Community involvement, education, and that's just me and our board, you know, being involved, even things like this. You know, we're trying to provide feedback to folks in general so you understand what's going on in farming and understand, you know, all the challenges that farming is facing, what's taking place, what's new, what's innovative. And so that's a big part. Public relations and advocacy, do get involved, you know, not in a political nature. We're not a PAC group. But if there's public policy, if it's farm bills, if it's certain regulatory issues, we do get involved from time to time just to look after the interest of that industry. Promotion, we do have, and I'll show you this a little bit later, we've got our own little branding for Henderson County and try to promote what's being grown here, promoting it to not just within the county but outside the county. And then one of the main things I tell people as much as anything, I serve as a coordinator. It's just matchmaking. Matchmaking with, if you've got a company looking to move here that's in an agricultural business, matching them up with the right piece of property, finding somebody that wants to sell, helping them find the right people to produce for them, markets. You know, it's a lot of matchmaking and just coordinating of some of these business type transactions. As an overview, we've got 400, this is statistics show, that we've got 468 farms currently and almost 36,000 acres. That's about 15% of the county that is in agricultural use. That last figure, though, is one that's concerning. And if you may recall, 2002 to 2012, there was a 10-year period of time, and this is going off of ag census reports, which are done every 5 years. And so that goes over that, covering a 10-year period, two of the reporting periods, that we lost almost 13,000 acres of farmland. And that was during that time period, we had a residential boom like crazy in Henderson County. So farmland was being taken out of farm use because the higher value of that property was put it in a subdivision. And so we saw a lot of that. That in part led to the formation of Agribusiness Henderson County, in trying to preserve our farmlands and maintain that open space and the ag production.
Now, what's the difference between full and part-time farms?
This would be the farmers themselves. There are many of our farmers, you know, have other employment. Some may be school teachers, and so that's basically what we're looking at. What Henderson County typically you think of farming, you think of is apples, and it's certainly a big part. We're looking about 3 million bushels a year, roughly. Now we're about up to $34 million in annual sales, and that's just the fruit itself, not anything of the value-added nature with the ciders and other items that are produced from the apples. That's just straight crop. See there, just a picture of kind of the new systems being used. This is a high-density orchard. We're seeing less acreage, but we're seeing high production because some of the type orchards, and this one is one that this one came into production probably in a two-year period. The unique part about some of these systems is it takes a lot fewer years for it to come into production. Historically, you'd set an apple tree, and it'd be 6-7 years before you'd see a crop. With these, that this type of a training system, with the trellis system, they can actually see a crop in second year and third year, seeing really pretty much a full crop. So you got all that expense, and you start recouping some of that cost a lot faster. So it's much more
really
manageable.
Really briefly explain what that is?
Or yeah,
what
this is.
Yeah,
I'm really
you
curious.
See,
yeah.
It almost like, I mean, think of grapevines. I mean, is probably what you typically think of seeing like that. They stake, each individual tree is staked because it's a very slender type of a trunk on the tree, and so it needs that support system. And then likewise, you've got high tension wire that's holding it in place as well.
The unique part about it is now you've basically got a wall of a tree, and you get, whenever you get fruit production, you get a wall of fruit production.
So you're training the trees to grow
That's
straight
exactly
up.
Right. And tree,
and
those lateral branches, you want to pull a branch down. And so you can see, you can't really see the detail, but they'll pull those branches down and tie them off to these wires. It's when that branch is pulled down, you get that lateral growth, is when you get fruit production.
Hmm.
So, I mean, it's, you know, it's pretty scientific. It's not just something that people just came up with. So there's a purpose behind it. The other good part about it is, and he's still got, you know, enough width as he grows, you're getting good sunlight, you get good tree rot, you get good fruit ripening, you get larger, more uniform fruit.
Does it make it easier to harvest as well?
It's much easier to harvest.
Because it's not
keeping
round.
The height at a level to where, you know, they may still get some ladder, but for the most part, if you're my height, you can probably get there and pick most of the apples,
so,
you know, from the ground. So there's
it's pretty
advantageous cool. From a labor standpoint. But I can also tell you on a per acre basis, this orchard probably costs about $20,000 per acre just to put in place. So it's not inexpensive. But we are seeing more and more growers take up this technique.
Do we have a lot of farms that are starting to go this
way? A lot of the new orchards are. I've got, as I mentioned, I got my orchard leased, and the farmer that's taking care of it, he wanted to transition to some newer varieties, and so I've got an orchard now that is actually set last year. Within a year or so, it'll look like this. So
if they produce sooner, do they also live longer because they're not as strained?
Not necessarily. And part of what happens, too, is varieties change, markets change. And so, I mean, now everybody thinks Honeycrisp. Well, you know, it'll be something else in a few years. So in reality, they're changing these trees out probably more frequently. But they can afford to do that because they're coming into production, you know, in less than half the time of traditional systems.
How long would it take to get a return back on that 20? How long would it take for it to pay for itself?
It'll start paying for itself usually by about the fifth, sixth year.
Interesting.
Another part of Henderson County's agriculture that we, you know, sometimes think of, but you don't think of it being really the number one part as a group, and that's the green industry. It's greenhouses, sod production, and ornamentals. You know, you think of the trees and so forth, the growth for you know, just putting in for landscaping. We rank second in the state, roughly, if you combine all that together, all those categories together, $43 million. That was in 2012. It's probably bumped up since then. And almost 2,000 acres, 72 farms. You see the greenhouses. And greenhouses, I can tell you, there's more and more of a trend towards greenhouse production because you get to, you're controlling all of your environment. Mm-hmm. And that controlled environment offers a lot of advantages. And we have a just ideal area for greenhouse production. We've got a moderate climate, doesn't get extremely hot, doesn't get extremely cold. But the key thing is we have great high quality water and we have a lot of sunlight in the winter months. And that sunlight in the winter months, you get that passive, that solar heat for the houses. And we are in a really unique location. That's the reason Art Van Wingerden with Van Wingerden International chose to come here back in the early 70s. And some of our more recent projects followed suit. And I think we'll continue to see more of that. Here's one of our sod fields. You see there, that's a mesh that is laid to keep the root system intact. That's what the field looks like when the grass comes into production. That's a pivot irrigation system. It's a center pivot. If you go to the end of that, there's actually a well, and so it's drawing from that well, and the thing turns in a circle. The circle irrigation system. And we've got about five of those in the county, and all of them are located on our sod farms because they're flat, large fields. And then just some of our ornamental trees in production. Trihistal, I don't know how many of you are familiar with this. This has been kind of our poster project that we've worked on. I've spent literally 2.5 years working on this project of bringing together companies from Israel, Italy, and then U.S.-based company. And it is it's a greenhouse operation. They do grafted vegetables, which is very unique. And it's something that is really just beginning to catch on in the U.S. Been doing it for probably 30, 40 years in other areas, in Israel and Europe. Fruit trees are common. I mean, every fruit tree out there is a grafted tree. Plants, a soft tissue plant, is a very, it's much more difficult. You know, getting the union right between and that graft union. I will mention too, it's not, you know, people don't realize this, it's non-GMO. I mean, you're basically taking a healthy, strong root system of a compatible, let's say watermelon. Okay, watermelon is in the same family as a gourd. So you may take the root system of a gourd, which is very hardy and more resilient to disease than, say, that watermelon plant itself. So they'll grow a watermelon, they'll grow a gourd, cut each plant and put the top watermelon and the bottom gourd and develop a much stronger, hardier plant. And the good things are higher yielding. Typically, always, if it's not worth the cost involved to do that. But it's higher yielding, more resistant to disease, so you get much, much less need for chemical input. Just actually, too, and get by with less plants. So there are many, many advantages to it. It is costly, but the returns have proven to be strong enough to support that added cost. But this is out in Mills River now. This is the facility there, brand new, and that'll continue to expand. That's what the young plants look like. You see the little clip there holding the graft, holding the two pieces in place.
They gave me a couple of plants, and I planted them in my backyard, and one of them grew 14 tomatoes. I enjoyed the last one.
Well, the other good thing about it, you can even take, you know, like some of our heirloom varieties, and which are not very resilient to disease, surprisingly. But in this case, you know, now you get a strong root system, and so you can plant some, you know, better varieties. Tomato production, we're second in the state, and about 600 acres. Most all of the tomato farms are fairly large. Sweet corn, we're number three in the state there, doing about $1 million worth of sweet corn a year. So you can see some of these fields. I mean, that's not field corn, that's sweet corn there by the trailer load. And then blackberry and raspberries, and that continues to grow at a fairly steady rate. Fruit and vegetables, we rank third in the state. And all these figures vary from year to year.
Is that ranking by production?
It's ranked typically by, well, they rank it by production. They rank it also by dollar volume as well. So it's kind of a combination. We still, even though we've lost many, many of our dairies and continue to lose some, we're still seventh in the state in dairy production. We've got one particularly that's very large with taproot. There you see just for the cash input direct farm without having any value added aspect of it, we look at about $120 million in production in a normal year. But the bigger figure are the businesses that are very directly associated with agriculture and completely dependent upon agriculture, particularly our packers and shippers. That's when we start really getting into to the larger dollars from an economic standpoint. So we're looking at about, these are numbers that I've compiled because there's just not a lot of great data out there, but I'm looking at about $515 million there. That'd be, see, packing houses here, apples going through there, those are being packaged, you know, going to grocery stores. You know, and that's some nice Henderson County apples. Tomatoes, likewise. We're packing a lot of items. Storage is actually very big business, storage and distribution. There's a facility that was a produce facility and converted that over to this right here, which is Bold Rock Hard Cider. Some of you may recognize that, but they are using a lot of North Carolina apples, and so very much an integral part of agribusiness for our area. This I put in there just to kind of show one area where we've had a lot of projects taking place. I call it the triangle in Mills River. You can see this is a proposed site, Trihistral. Trihistral now sits right here. We'll eventually broaden out to this area. You had there's that packing facility I showed you, which is now Bold Rock Hard Cider. We were able to get sewer lines extended out and got water extended out so that it's now suitable for these type of businesses. You've got here, this, I look at this as just kind of a hub for agribusinesses. You've got Flavor First Growers and Packers. You've got Van Wingerden Greenhouses. You've got now what's Gaia Herbs. You've got Greenhouse Manufacturing Company, more greenhouses. There's Mills River Park. This right here is about to become a new dairy. So there's just the center of a lot of what takes place in agriculture. Now, we don't have apple production. All of our fruit production and berry production takes place in the eastern side of the county, east of I-26. A lot of our vegetable production and greenhouse production takes place west of I-26. So it's just a lot of it has to do with elevation, the topography of the land, many things. But agribusiness, agriculture, from direct jobs, you can see we're just about 3,000. We get a lot of seasonal labor, but we also have supported jobs through agriculture. So it would say full-time jobs about 4,300, and then seasonally we're pushing about 3,000 now. So there, just in summary, you see from agriculture, agribusiness, total impact about $625 million. And employment close to 7,000 jobs. There are other businesses that I've not included in that. Then you get the manufacturer, I think I've included all that, but then you get trucking companies, you get some equipment dealers, suppliers, other markets, and then you start looking about professional folks, that's required as well. Another really big piece that's not included in that $625 million is agritourism, and that's becoming bigger and bigger as well. I'll show you just a few figures there for the tourism piece. I mean, you think of our street festivals, farm stands, some of the typical items, and now we're seeing wineries and cideries. Apple Festival alone runs about $12 million. If it weren't for apples, we wouldn't have an Apple Festival. So you have to say that the two kind of go hand in hand. Garden Jubilee, which is a growing event, that's $1 million. The Ag Center, which is actually in Buncombe County, but it's North Henderson, so we kind of share that. It sits right there on the line, basically, and that's about $13 million a year. You get a traditional tourism, our fruit stands, particularly if you go this time of year. If you hadn't done this, please do. Go out Highway 64 beyond Walmart and just keep going from there all the way down to Batcave. And you'll see more fruit stands and activities there than you could ever stop at. But you're doing a great job. There's Lida Farms, been around for a long time. They've always been known for their, you know, apples and produce, but pumpkins especially. They do a great job with their pumpkins. Skytop, most people familiar with Skytop. Everybody, it's incredible. I mean, we're talking, you know, 5,000-6,000 people in a weekend.
Amazing.
And it's just it's unreal the amount of folks that visit some of these places. We get some unique things too. You see some corn mazes and things like that popping up. North River Farms, you know, they're really taking advantage, trying to educate people on the importance of you know, the not just the land but of the water, and getting kids out and explaining and educating them about, you know, how the importance of farming and taking care of the natural resources so they can continue the next generation to farm. So they've done a great job of that. And certainly, like I said, our wineries, Burnt Shirt and St. Paul are ones that are most everybody's probably pretty familiar with those. We've got a couple more that may be coming on board as well. This thing's, there we go. Slow responding. And our hard cider, we've got really three main ones. Flat Rock Cider Works produces Naked Apple, Bold Rock out in Mills River, and then Wallace, which is tied in with St. Paul. So you've got those three. I'll go ahead and let the cat out of the bag. We're actually working right now. We'll have a cider festival next April. So we're going to have that on Main Street, the April 22nd. So this will be the first year, but we've got these groups together. We'll bring in other cider operations that we are supplying apples to throughout the state. So we hope we'll have about 15 cider producers here.
Cool.
So.
Awesome.
At Bold Rock, most everybody's familiar there with them. Uh-oh.
Which also happens to be Earth Day, right?
What did I do? Mm-hmm. Just do quick.
Earth Day or Arbor Day.
And then, there's kind of the viewing area for in the bar area at Bold Rock. One other thing we do is promoting local grown stuff. That Southern Mountain Fresh is kind of our branding initiative that we've taken on for agribusiness in Henderson County. Sometimes get a chance, check it out, southernmountainfresh.com, and it'll give some listings of what's green grown, what's in season right now, and where you can go locally to buy that. We do a social media campaign with it to promote it. We advertise some in the papers. You know, most of what we're doing is through social media. You'll see that little logo time to time around at some of our local markets. All this is, I like to tell people too, all these pictures I use are all from Henderson County. Everything's authentic. It's all of our local growers. Let me shift gears now and talk a little bit about agriculture and the county and how it relates to environment and what's kind of taking place. This is kind of a long list. I'm kind of good for you to explain some of these things. But best management practices, that's a term that our farmers are very familiar with, BMPs. And they're familiar with it because they're using it. And now, more than ever, each generation that I see coming along being part of agriculture, I think is becoming keenly aware of the need to take care of those natural resources. And I see folks really changing their practices and doing a really good job. There are always room for improvement, always will be. But I think that the mindset has changed greatly, and that's, to me, is encouraging. And it's also, you know, helps them be sustainable in multiple ways. You know, sustainable in terms of as it relates to the environment, but also sustainable in terms of being economically viable too. So they get the message, they're getting it, and they're implementing it. Some of the practices, what we would consider, you know, BMPs, stream bank, and erosion stabilization. I'll show you some examples of all of these. Stormwater ponds, retention ponds, even in many cases where maybe it's not required, we're seeing more and more of our operations voluntarily doing some stuff they don't have to do, but they're doing it because they're trying to be good stewards, trying to be good neighbors. And I should emphasize that whole concept of it being voluntary. That works very well. You go out, you tell an independent kind of self-reliant farmer, you know, you got to do this, you got to do that. Usually it's going to bow up on you a little bit. But whenever folks work with and communicate with our farmers, they'll find that they're very cooperative and they're very willing to listen and to learn and to implement. Sometimes things are very costly and they try to do it within their budgets and try to do things that they can. But I've got some great examples. I think, you know, Rachel mentioned that Maria Wise had come and spoken to the group from Mills River Partnership. I serve on that board. I can tell you that has been a unique relationship between farmers that can sometimes be very independent. We've got, you know, Carolina Mountain Land Conservancy's in there. Trout Unlimited is in there. Who else? I'm forgetting a bunch, I know. Forestry Service is in there. But you get, you know, folks that have a stronger concern, environmental concern, folks that are concerned about their businesses, a unique group, but it's worked well. The dynamics have been good, amazingly good, because it's done on a voluntary system, and a lot of education, a lot of talking back and forth. So a lot of these things,
taking place as practices coming out of the group. Monitoring all of these things, water, soil, and pests, to where people know, you know, what's going in the water. They know, you know, if there's a problem. The soil, getting soil samples done, not just going out and applying fertilizer and so forth, or any sort of chemicals at all, if it's not needed. Same way with pests, and managing and monitoring and paying for scouts to come in the fields and orchards so that there's a scalpel approach to pest control instead of a broadcast shotgun approach. Saves them money, helps the environment. Spray sheds, and I'll show you some examples of those if you're not familiar with them. Buffers, grass wave, all of that, even the orientation of roads so that you cut down on erosion. That's being implemented. Cover crops, we've got some examples I'll show you for low-till and no-till. Recycling, and then call it actually RPCs, recyclable plastic containers. That's very common now. It's almost required, in fact, in many cases. Then just reduce chemical use, you know, through some of these practices, and particularly on new technologies like that grafted plant. You know, if you're using those grafted plants, then you really can cut down on a lot of your chemical applications. Biological pest controls. I'm excited about this because we've got some folks I'm working with even right now that are looking at even some production of beneficial insects, which basically you're taking natural insects that prey on those that cause harm and damage to our fruit and vegetables. And so instead of chemical application of pesticides, you're getting a natural predator that's being introduced. I mean, we think of things commonly like, you know, ladybugs or praying mantis and things like that. But there are also other little bugs out there, mites, like there's a predator mite that preys on a spider mite, which wreaks havoc on strawberries and other fruit, but there's a mite that will eat that mite. And so as long as everything's done and done in balance and these people know how to handle that, how to manage that, then it reduces your chemical application. So there's a lot of biological controls. All this stuff's cutting edge, new technology, and it's in Henderson County today, and farmers are using these things. Keep things local. I mean, there's a huge push for that right now, and it's been great. It's benefited us, you know, economically, too, because we're a big producer for western end of North Carolina. We're the biggest ag producer in western North Carolina by far. So, you know, we're benefiting from this.
Let me just now kind of show you a few pictures and tell you a little bit about it. There's some stream bank stabilization and road stabilization all in one shot. There's a little pond. And you see some buffers around it. That's retention pond. There's another one there. That's out from the Van Wingerden. I don't know what I hit. That thing's going wild. Another northern stormwater retention pond. Just this water sampling coming from the rivers. There's a that's the trap to see what bugs are there. I don't know what I have hit, Rachel, but this thing's going on its own.
It escaped. That always works.
Yeah. It'll take me right out. Let's go back. I don't know what I've hit. It's going nuts. I was going to go fast, but I wasn't going to go quite that fast.
Well, it stopped.
Yeah, I
clicked.
Yeah. You
want to
go back a few?
Yeah, go back a few. That's good right there.
Okay.
This is a little, you may not know about it, this is a trap. I mean, it's got pheromones in there from bugs, and so the bad bugs, number one, they can be used in a number of ways. You can have pheromones in there, but you also just get a population of whatever bugs are around and traffic, so you kind of know what's there, what you're dealing with. So a farmer can identify that, know how to deal with it appropriately. So it's not just some random applications to rid the orchard or the field of pests. Okay. Let's try this. I'm going forward or backwards. Of course, there everybody's seen water samples being taken. I'm going the other way now, but that's retention pond. That's out at Tri-Histal, where they've built their new facilities. quite frankly, they didn't have to build this retention pond, this stormwater pond, but they chose to because they felt like it was the right thing to do. And they can actually use some of their water and recycling it and use it into watering plants. This is a spray shed. I mentioned spray shed. Any of you familiar with these? Know how they work?
I know the basics. What I've heard from, I mean, I've seen talks with NRCS where they talk about
The spray shed. That's okay.
You're all staying here.
Okay, you start. Yeah, you
can.
This
is basically set up so that if you're filling up a sprayer with any type of chemical, you've got it, number one, it's undercover. So if there's rainfall, you're not getting a wash from that. This is all done on concrete with a catch basin there. So if there's any sort of spillage, any runoff whatsoever, it's capturing that. It's not just spilling out in the fields and in the streams and everything else. You've got any sort of pest control locked up in a building so that it's all secured, nobody can get into it. Everything's captured and then can be, you know, handled appropriately without any sort of spillage whatsoever. These things started back in this area. There was some money on a cost share program done through Soil and Water Conservation Office. And I can't even tell you how many we have now in the county. We've got at least 50, you know, probably more than that. And it's been a great program, and they've worked very well. Those all have been engineered to be very efficient in what they do. And so most all of our farms now, particularly our big farms, do have these types of facilities.
Have most of those been put in with the cost share program?
It is mostly through cost share. It has been. And Mildred Partnership, even some of the Great Safe Secure, they've helped and assisted with some of those. Cost share programs generally run where about 75% of that cost is covered, and then the landowner or the farmer covers the other 25%. That's traditionally been about the way it runs. There again, I mean, some of these things, I mean, these things are not cheap. I mean, especially whenever you get the government involved, the government does the engineering and says you got to do this. I mean, so they're not cheap. So, you know, for somebody to put it in, I mean, you've got to have bought into the idea that this is good. This is good for me long term, good for the environment. And so farmers are doing that. Here, this is just an example of grassways. You know, historically, you might have seen fields and just all mud and runoff and so forth. But seeing more and more use of, you know, grass going in and sowing grass. You know, so you got filter systems and buffers. And there again, and you see this is, you can't tell, but I mean, this is a stream over here. And so, again, pulling the fields in, drawing in, using a little bit of less land and keeping buffers in place. So that in a flood event, you know, if you have runoff, and go ahead and get up next one. This is actual field after a flood. You can tell if you see the grass build up there. This is a side field. This is from hurricane activity about 4 years ago. And, you know, with measures in place like those buffers, even if you have a flood event, you sort of minimize any impact of runoff, you know, in terms of erosion or any chemicals, anything like that getting in the stream. Go ahead. And there again, see Mildred Partnership, and that's been a great organization. Again, because it's voluntary, and it's just people working together in a good way. This is a drill for seeding. Go ahead, go to the next picture. It basically eliminates the need, when you're sowing certain crops, it eliminates the need to till the soil. To traditionally, to go in the plows and turn the soil over every year. There's a need to do that sometimes just to condition the soil. But this eliminates the need for having to do it every year, and so it saves on erosion. This is a machine that was purchased with some cost share money, but it's on loan to all farmers. So yeah, everybody doesn't have to go out and buy one, so there's availability of that. Go ahead.
Does that have a name? Is there an official name for that type of machine? seed drill?
It's a drill.
I was just curious.
No-till drill. This is a farm. This is actually organic and certified property there, and they're actually doing some of that. You also see some cover crops there too. This is mentioning about the recyclable containers. That picture's a little bit dark. But these, and you've all seen them probably, the plastic, black plastic container, IFCO, the company that rents those out. But everything's being picked in those pretty much anymore. And so those get washed, they get cycled back. Farmers have to keep track of the numbers they've got. They basically contract the numbers, and then they've got to account for all those numbers, and they're working with the buyers. But it's a cost involved. But still, nonetheless, it saves on cardboard. Cardboard that is being used, whether you know it or not, from a food safety standpoint, a cardboard box gets used one time, like a tomato box, pretty sturdy box, maybe a wax box. You use it one time only. You get it, dump the tomatoes out, and there's a box. You can't use it but one time. That's a food safety law. That's my fault and your fault. As consumers, we've demanded high standards for food safety, and so in turn, those things can only be used once. At least those are being recycled. They're being crushed and put in a big old bundle or a bale, and so they get recycled. But to me, I've always hated that, to see a box. It's basically, once you dump the product out of it, it still looks brand new, but it's got to get crushed. Those RPCs are a good alternative to prevent all that. Here again, just showing new technology with the grafted plants and that. Advantages that that offers. That's just a bloom. I didn't touch on it, but with the beneficial insects, certainly another big beneficial insect with pollinators. Most of you know honeybees, that's been a big issue. Seeing honeybee population really diminish. Most of these companies that work with the production of pollinators will actually produce bumblebees for the honeybees. They're not having the same problems with honeybee and the survival rate. And a bumblebee is actually much, much more efficient as a pollinator than a honeybee. And so bumblebees are being seen as another resource. And so farmers are using those extensively. And as chemicals, as we learn, certain chemicals that are harmful to honeybees, those continue to go off the market whenever that's recognized. They're going away. Farmers are moving away from anything that they see that could be harmful. So practices, constant change. It's learning and moving forward. Then the other aspect, I would say, from an environmental standpoint is local. You just don't have to drive in this county. You don't have to drive very far at all to find local growth food. So that's certainly an advantage. You'll see. See our logo there. A lot of these fruit stands around will have that logo because they're members and they're on our website. Then North Carolina's got a program, got to be NC. And we work closely with the North Carolina Department of Agriculture, work hand in hand with them a great deal. And then kind of last year, we are in agriculture. Whether you realize it or not, most people don't. Agriculture is still the number one industry in North Carolina. We're at $84 billion a year in production, and the goal is by 2020 that we hit $100 billion.
What's the second industry?
I'm not sure. Probably textile industry.
Textile?
Still. It used to be much higher. It could be technology by now, or
tobacco is
banking
it?
Industry. Well, off the back of the engine. Okay. By far, this livestock industry, we don't have it in this area, but poultry, swine, it's huge. North Carolina's huge. In terms of crop type production, or next down going down the line, it would be sweet potatoes. We're not sweet potatoes. We are a specialty crop area. We're doing fruit and vegetables. In the state, fruit and vegetables. Take a guess, how much percentage, and eliminate, taking out sweet potatoes, the fruits and vegetables, what percentage would you think it would make up of all of the state of North Carolina?
The ones produced in Henderson County?
No, just as a whole, fruit and vegetable, from North Carolina fruit and vegetable production, what percentage of all agriculture in North Carolina do you think it would make up?
30?
60%. Oh.
Less than 5%.
What?
Root
and vegetable.
And that's measured by a dollar amount?
Yeah. Root and vegetable production as a whole in the state of North Carolina is less than 5%.
What is there?
That's why all the farmers always want to have cows on the side. That's it. Yeah.
The high numbers are in poultry.
That's crazy.
And swine and
turkey.
That's right.
So I have two questions for you. So you gave a bunch of numbers about like ranking the various industries here, and you gave and said you're saying about some of them growing.
Right.
The first question is: are there any that come to mind that are on the decline and have been, and you see them continuing that way?
I see less and less ornamentals, which is non-food product.
Like specialty trees and stuff?
Yes. There's no question that's declined in the county, and I think it's continuing to. Now, that's not the case necessarily for plant production, but really, truly, we've got one big plant producer, that's Van Wingerden, and they've not grown, but they've stayed the same for many years. They actually sold a piece of property to Tri-Histal because they didn't see themselves expanding in the near future by any means, so it worked out. They thought, well, here's ground that actually had been prepped many, many years ago for greenhouse, and they just didn't see that they were going to be expanding, so they were willing to sell out to another greenhouse operation, which is producing plants, but plants for food production. But I think more and more you're going to see some decline in those areas. Even our sod production for the county has been pretty cyclical, as we see booming economies where a lot of residential development. Sod producers do very well right now. Things have kind of rebounded. They've actually got a very low inventory. They could expand their production right now. But take another economic decline, and that'll cycle through too. But ornamentals definitely have reduced. Now, where I see growth areas, again, I see greenhouses, a lot of growth in greenhouse. I see on a small scale, where I see good opportunities for young people would be like in blackberry production, because it's a high-yielding, high-end type crop. It doesn't require an enormous amount of acreage. It requires a good bit of investment, but it's a good way for a younger farmer to kind of get started and to kind of grow into it. But I was actually appointed to the state task force for North Carolina Food Manufacturing. The initiative that's taking place at the state level is to try to match up what we're growing within the state with folks that are doing the value-added piece in the process. Whether you know this or not, Texas Peat is a North Carolina company. It's been in Texas. And Texas Peat is Garner Food Company, which is down west of Salem. They actually also have a company that purchased Green Mountain Salsa, which is from Vermont, and they purchased that. But this just gets me that they're producing the salsa using tomatoes that come from California. So they're importing, and not just come from California, they're packaged very expensively. It's aseptic packaging. It's processed up there, packaged, put an aseptic package, come here, and then take them out of the package and then putting it together. Part of this initiative is to look for more and more ways that we can take our own production, what's being produced here within the state, match that up with folks doing the process. Maybe they're already here, maybe they're moving in, and keep things produced, basically, you'd say, a smaller carbon footprint all the way around. But it just makes sense economically, environmentally, it makes sense all the way around. So there's a good initiative there. We're fortunate enough to be involved with that from the ground level. So a lot of opportunities. Go ahead and do the next slide. This is really the last one. You never thought about this. You see where we're positioned. Look at the population around us. In close proximity, you first think of Charlotte and Atlanta, but then get on into Nashville. We're working too with farm groups and a lot of close ties with Florida, all the way to South Florida, up into Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and in some others in Ohio. But we're just not that far away. you know, we're within about a day's drive by truck of most of these marketplaces. So we're lacking here in terms of growth for agriculture is we're in a mountainous area. We don't have so much farmland available. That's the reason that we tend to end up more on the higher end production of things. I think we'll see some more growth in greenhouses, but even there, we only have so much land available, you know, for growth. So we're making the most of what we have and working with other areas. You look at economies of scale, and so we do collaborate a lot with our neighbors around us, both in terms of supply as well as meeting the demands of the market. So that's we've got the last slide. I've got my contact information, but that's what I've got. So I've taken quite a bit of time. If you get questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Do you have 1 minute real quick?
Sure.
I don't want to keep you up if you got some.
That's okay.
Can you explain briefly how the, because you talked about these food companies or these, how does that interact with the local farmer? How does that relationship work?
It provides a market for them very often.
So is there like a large company and they like?
They'll purchase, give you an example.
You know, like, yeah.
Yeah,
so
an example would be Flavor First Growers and Packers. Mm-hmm. They are called the grower, packer, shipper. They do a lot of their own growing their own product, but they also pack for other farmers. So other farmers sell to them, and they pack their product as well, and then they are shipping out to chain stores. That's very common. In fact, more and more, unless something's being sold, let's say, on a much smaller scale, you know, through a direct market like a roadside stand or through a farmer's market, tailgate markets, and things like that, your larger producers are typically going to be working with a packer or distributor. Mm-hmm. And we've got several of them.
Yeah.
We've got Apple Wedge packers. They grow, and they grow and pack for other people, and then they're a distributor. Lipman Produce, which is huge, and they're the same way. New facility took place in an older operation. It's now four J's Produce and Apples. They're doing that. So there's a lot of that. Alan Henderson, with Henderson's Bay, he does that. So having a packing facility, it makes no sense for every farmer to have his own packing facility or his own storage facilities. So they work together. They can't always grow enough to justify the cost of that facility, so they have to work with other growers. And again, it's just a common scale.
Is that usually some kind of contract they have between the farmer and the company?
More often than not,
annual.
It's not. Usually it's annual. And it's all based on relationships, you know, especially whenever it's local. Each party knows what they're dealing with.
Right.
And it's kind of a love-hate relationship at times that they work through.
Is part of your task force that you're on, is part of it working with grocery stores to get more local produce into our local?
It has been. The task force has done its initial job. I've been told that there'll be a phase two, so it'll start back up. But yes, it was actually to identify work with the State Commerce Department and for some contract companies to identify people that they felt like they were in business that would be good matches for the state of North Carolina, and actually to do a recruitment. But first and foremost, to focus on North Carolina companies, and again, just on almost on a state scale, do what I'm doing on a county scale, and that's matching folks up. And it just makes sense.
I was told, and I can't remember the source, that North Carolina is one of the states that's experimenting with growing crops that it doesn't usually grow in case something happens to the Midwest. Drought, whatever.
Sure.
Is that a rumor?
North Carolina is a very progressive agricultural state. We're actually the third most diverse in our ag production in the U.S., only behind California and Florida. And so we are very diverse in our agricultural production. I tell people, even in terms of Henderson County, we can grow about anything except citrus type stuff and tropical fruit. And if you get in the greenhouse environment, you can grow that. Just, you know, it's just not economically feasible to do it.
Do you have any
and now hops.
You got hops, and there are more. You know, it's hops takes quite a bit of acreage, and hops is going to be something that we never, I don't think, in the mountain here, will be able to grow on the scale in which the demands for it are. You know, for specialty type brews and things like that, seasonal brews, yes. I mean, I've talked to some folks recently, they talk about doing hops in a greenhouse, and that just blows my mind because...
What's the constraint? It needs a more humid?
It's we're too humid. We've got too much moisture. You get problems with mildew.
That's right.
So that's the bigger challenge. Most of your hops are grown in the northwest, and it's grown in a drier climate than what we have here.
Yeah, we've got the right temperature, but not the right...
The humidity levels are too high.
Are you hearing from farmers? Are they? Sometimes I read in the paper that they're concerned that the younger generations that are coming up aren't going to take over the family's, you know, industry or niche. I mean, are you hearing that from the folks you work with?
Yeah, it's an ongoing concern, and again, I see cycles there. But recently, I've seen more and more young people show interest, and I'm talking, you know, the next generation. I'll give you an example, Johnson Family Farm. Joe Kirby Johnson built fruit stand out on Earthwood. Well, he's done that because he's got his daughters, the next generation, involved, and he's even involved with grandchildren to try to get them interested. I've seen Tri-Histol, the general manager out there, his daughters, she's working in part of the operation. And it's because, you know, it's not, farming is not traditional in the sense that it's not just out there working in the dirt like it used to be. It's highly technical. High technology type stuff. What takes place? I mean, you're even tractors on a large scale. These tractors are using GPS, and I mean, they're self-guided. I mean, you know, I mean, they're way ahead of, you know, you think about automated cars and so forth. I mean, tractors, I mean, you're out there in the field. I mean, you set your coordinates and away it goes. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's high tech stuff. And so that attracts the next generation a little bit better, too.
Do you think there's we've participated in CSAs for some time, and I've heard some farmers going away from CSAs to predominantly or sticking with wholesale because they can make better margins, better money. Do you think that's the best model to get, I guess, local produce in markets rather than getting us to connect directly with the farms? Is that more sustainable
it's,
in some way?
It's cyclical. You know, yeah. I've seen it go both ways. Some of you may know Danny McConnell. Danny's done a great job for many years. Danny made a comment to me the other day. He said there's so many farmers now that are looking at doing these tailgate markets and retail. He's really given some consideration now to going back more wholesale.
Okay.
Again, I've always tell people it's hard to be all things to all people.
Sure.
In terms of, you know, doing the growing and doing a really good job of growing and doing the marketing, the distribution, the sales, and all that stuff. There's so many components there. And especially if you're doing any processing involved with it. So it's just hard for one operation to do everything.
Makes sense.
So it's just trying to find the niche. Now, fortunately, we're in an area, we've kind of got it all. Well, yeah. We've got people that can produce, we've got people that can market, people can process. You know, so we really are in a great area.
Yeah. So I guess the key is we should be as flexible as our farmers are.
I have seen probably a little less interest in the CSAs, mm-hmm. partly in this area because we've got so many direct markets available to
us. Makes sense.
And then you think in terms of like markets, like you think of big restaurants. Well, we've got a lot of restaurants around. There's a great opportunity for farmers. Think about
volume.
Serving sizes to get volume up there.
Yeah.
Volume is not there. So yeah. Most of the restaurants, I mean, they're going to go to the same place you're going to get your products as well. They're going to go to small markets, tailgate markets, and so forth as well.
Oh, that raises one more question for you, Mark. I'm sorry to keep belaboring you. I've heard more about the gleaning, you know, stuff that's not pretty enough to go to the restaurant or supermarket, you know, folks getting that to folks who are underserved. Are you seeing
a lot
more of
that? One girl in particular really utilizes that's Jason Davis. He's he's at North Mills River Farm.
Okay.
He's done that a lot. Really worked with St. Andrews Society, St. Andrews.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they'll come in each year and he tries to get volunteers to come in and help with the harvest. Basically, they'll go in a field that's already been harvested, and there's always stuff that didn't get harvested. Or if the market's not great, Mm-hmm. You get sometimes overproduction, and it's just not feasible to go out and pay the harvest cost. Mm-hmm. You know, then they'll turn that over so that, you know, food supply can be available. Wow. Those are the fortunate. Have you ever seen a lot of that?
Mm. Nice. Thanks for your time today, right, Mark. This was very informative.
That was great.
Thank you. Thank you.
I didn't really put it together for that, for with that intent. So let's not. If there are certain pieces that you really like, then maybe I can pull some parts out.
Yeah, maybe.
Let's take a look at it. Yeah, take a look at it.
I'd like to get some of those numbers you had at the beginning about, you know, money
and
brought
them
in.
Down.
Part of the reason I've not put it out there, believe it or not, I mean, I've put a lot of time in compiling some of the stuff, and I find that some stuff gets claimed by other people and put out there a lot. I mean, I don't mind sharing information. I mean, that's, you know.
Sure.
But, yeah, well, that's, yeah. But I teach over at Blue Ridge. I was just going to use it in some as a local example.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks for
all right.
Comment.
Thanks a lot. Thank you,
Mark.
Thank you.
All right. Well, I feel better about our local agriculture after that. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. All that they're doing for us. That's very good.
We use a yardstick for our systems.
Good idea. I learned this week, I was at an energy conference, and I learned that there are more pigs than humans in our state, hogs.
Nice.
So just, if you wanted to know.
Wild
big
or?
Pig population.
No, like hog farming in eastern
hogs.
North Carolina and the central part, there's more hogs than people.
Huh.
Hogs per capita. Like 30 or 40 per one person or something insane.
Wow.
I'd have to feed them.
That's a whole lot of bacon.
Yes.
Next thing on our agenda for today, folks, is what we want to talk about for future meetings, our next meeting, things like that. Is there anything that's burning on your mind that you want to talk about, have us dig into based on what we've talked about so far this year?
I'd like to know what's going on with geothermal.
Mm.
Anybody's doing it. I know one person is doing it. But is that a trend? Is it?
I mean, as far as like for residential applications or just if anybody is doing it in general?
It can be on a commercial scale.
Yeah.
All that great temperature.
Right.
In the ground.
Yeah. I know I looked into it. But it's expensive.
Super expensive.
It's like Chris was saying, how long does it take for you make your money back? It's I think it was like a 10-year turn. And
that's not bad though.
I could be wrong.
We got a lot of trees around here.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody can do solar.
Yeah.
I don't know anyone unless we contact some kind of solar alternative energy type provider or installer. That maybe does that kind of work, but I don't really know anybody.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. I've heard somebody. So I think some of the HVAC companies may do it, actually.
I can ask my neighbor who put in geothermal.
Yeah, they want to send us some information, or if you wanted to bring something to the committee and share it.
That
was just such a neat
way to
go.
Yeah, it does. Okay, so
Very
Earth's not going anywhere.
Well, not yet.
Right, not today. So our categories were greenways, gardens, surface water, and energy efficiency.
Do we have anybody that could talk about community gardens or?
Pollinator
gardens.
Yeah, Liz.
Well, we have one.
Yeah.
We have two.
Yeah.
There's one in Jackson Park and there's one in Sullivan Park.
Right. And I mean, I don't know anything. I mean, I know the gist of it, but I don't know anything about it in detail. Like, who operates them, how they're set up.
We tried to get someone from the Hendersonville co-op come, but they couldn't come this month. They might come next month.
Who
they
would?
Gretchen.
Mm.
Oh, She was available, but we do also have a Master Gardeners program through the Henderson County Cooperative Extension, so they might be a really good resource, some of their Master Gardeners, maybe.
Yeah, there's
I
another.
I think they get food for IM.
Yeah, so I can be in touch with them and see if they could come next month or something if you wanted to try that.
Yeah, I was just looking at our list of what we have.
Okay.
I mean, I think community gardens was one of them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Someone who might be interesting for us to hear from, whether it's in, on this topic or something, you know, if we get into it further, is Kevin Todd. He used to be the local rep for Society of St. Andrew. But he's done internships at Community Garden in Black Mountain and one in Fairview that do a lot of this growing to give kind of thing. And so that might be cool because one of the things I always hear from community gardens, it's like, yeah, it was great at the onset, but... You know, who's pulling weeds, who's watering, who's doing
well,
that?
Well, that's what kind of stuff I'd like to hear about.
Like, what's
yeah.
that?
I can sure tell you what my experience has been.
Yeah.
It's been 5-6 years now.
Right.
Since we put it in, there are groundhog issues.
Right.
And now the voles have showed up.
Well, that's within the garden.
We can watch Caddyshack our next meeting.
I would just spray pesticides indiscriminately.
We haven't used any.
Get you a couple cats.
We had a couple cats. I saw them.
Sure.
There were two cats
licking
their
My cats catch moles all the time. I'll find holes that big in the garden.
I put in an ultrasonic thingy that
the solar one
buzzes every 30 seconds.
Yeah, can do that.
And they're leaving the lettuce alone now. I don't know if it's left.
Yeah, maybe Liz.
Working.
Yeah,
probably.
That'd be cool.
It helps with turkey.
Okay. Well, that sounds good. So we could dig into community gardens a bit more. Have Liz speak a little bit on her passion for keeping predators
out. What works, what doesn't.
Yeah, right. That'd be good to hear.
We also have whoever he is over at NRCS too. That I can't think of their title, but they're NRCS office has a person that does like.
Yes. Rachel, and she's at Soul and Water.
They're all named Rachel. So I mean, she does like BMP stuff. She like their that cost share program and stuff with the spray sheds and stuff. I've never met Rachel before.
Is that Soul and Water? Where's their office at?
She's federal. She's NRCS. So the federal government housed at Soil and Water.
Oh, okay.
They're off of 64. Soil and Water's office. So I did actually. Mark and I had talked.
Oh, they're near Walmart.
We got started. Yeah, just before that. About having Jonathan Wallen, who's the director of the Soil and Water, come and talk. It's probably going to be similar, but it's going to be from the district rather than like an organization or the county. So it may be a different perspective, but it may be a lot of the same stuff. I don't know. We can go back to that model that we had earlier last year, where we had 3 or 4 people come in one meeting. It's a lot of information, but.
Yeah.
We also didn't meet a couple times last year because of the weather.
That's true.
So that's something to consider as well.
Yeah. Before the meeting, Rachel and I were talking about trying to get as much in before the holidays come and weather, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So, and I also think if we get someone, like say we have 2 or 3, if we go ahead and tell them on the front end, hey, you've got 10 minutes and we want you to touch on these two things, and if you get questions, that allows us to kind of set a pace for the meeting a little better than it just, I mean, Mark gave us a great presentation, but it was lengthy. I mean, he kind of, his door swings both ways, so.
So what if we talk to Todd or the number of people mm-hmm. and get him to come, and then via email we could maybe get those talking points that we want them mm-hmm. to cover?
Definitely.
Instead of giving them their own.
Rain. Yes. I think that's good.
Yeah.
I think it's helpful to them, too, because they know what they're getting themselves into
mm-hmm.
and prepare ahead of time. Okay.
Well, so Rachel, could you do that, like email out name, title, organization? That way we can say, from that person, we can all just email back to maybe you could be the keeper of the talking
sure.
points.
Yeah.
That way we don't have to have a huge
yeah.
reply all. But
yeah.
Definitely. Sounds like a plan. Okay. Cool. And Rachel's got a couple of announcements for us. Switching gears just ever so slightly. you got a couple announcements for us, you said?
Yeah, we're closing the meeting here. What else you got for us?
I'll be very quick then. I have two more household hazardous waste events coming up. One is actually next Tuesday, which is October 11th, at the convenience center, and then simultaneously paint recycling is happening at the transfer station. So Tuesday 11th from 8:30 to 12, and then November 1st, which is also a Tuesday from 8:30 to 12.
For the pumpkin? Is that for pumpkin? Or recycling what?
It's our chemical collection program and then our paint collection program.
Okay.
I'm not sure if I'm doing pumpkin again. we'll see about that. That was fun though last year. And then we will have three more. We're moving our household hazardous waste programs into just spring and fall and taking out summer programs. So we won't have any again until probably March, April, May or something of that sort. And also, we will be introducing clothing recycling at the convenience center really soon. My goal is by the end of the month. So I'm working on all of the outreach and stuff like that, and it's going to be two red bins, and they basically look like a post office box, but they're red, and they're really tall. So you can recycle any gently used or worn and dry clothing and shoes, but no other household textiles. Mm-hmm. So not curtains, not bedspreads, not that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So totally free. It'll be open anytime the convenience center is available that you can bring those kinds of items there.
What are you gonna do with it?
Yeah, rather than
there's a company that does. There's only a few companies that do textile recycling in Western North Carolina, and they're not here. It's out of Durham actually, and they make a couple runs to get stuff from other counties. So, but they take it all back to a warehouse where they're located. Do some preliminary sorting.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, preliminary sorting to pull out really good versus really bad and reusable. Some get sold to companies in the United States to either reuse and make into new textiles or resell. And then what doesn't make it past that stage actually gets sold overseas mm-hmm. to a number of different countries who have textile processing. So it ends up going a lot of different places all over the world, just kind of depending on the quality.
Does the county get reimbursed for the?
It is. Some companies do offer a reimbursement to the collector pounds cents per pound, but we're not doing anything. And I was looking up some stats earlier, and it said something about only 15% of the 25 billion pounds of textiles created in the U.S. are recycled annually.
Wow.
And 5% of all landfill waste created annually in the U.S. is textiles. 5%, which is a lot. And if you think about it, it makes sense, because when it gets wet, it's very, very heavy.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, it really adds up. So we're looking to try and pull some of that out of the so that's coming. I'll let you know. I would definitely like to help in getting the word.
Just make sure we talk about that next Thursday when we're out there,
yeah.
In case I forget.
All right, and so I guess we basically, I already figured this out. We need to meet again next month to host our...
already figured it out, huh?
Well, I mean, by default, we kind of said we're meeting again next month. So same time, same place.
And it'll be a long one, right?
We can, if
like
we get our questions...
Plan for it to be long?
We don't need to, I think we keep it to an hour.
Yeah.
There's no reason not to.
Okay.
If we give them the three things he wants to talk about, instead of...
But it's not just going to be one person, though, is it?
No, so if we have Kevin, if we have Soul of Water, and this gives us some liner notes on...
I can do a write-up.
You can also share your information with the committee prior to the meeting, and then if you don't want to
That's
talk
true.
Or do anything like that...
Well, what I was trying to do was give everybody something in writing so they could just read it. And then
yeah.
if you have questions, rather than do a presentation for 10 minutes.
Oh.
Perfect.
But that means I have to be
what
the
heck is
just run it all down.
We'll give you a deadline.
The third.
Better give me a deadline.
Get a gold star at the meeting. Right. Okay, perfect.
So November 3rd.
So it's November 3rd.
When exactly do you want to start it?
ASAP.
A Halloween.
Yeah.
I like to try to send everything out for the committee at least 1 week exactly prior to the meeting, so
oh.
you can do it by like the 24th or the 25th, so I can have it out by the 27th.
Okay.
So 3 weeks.
all know, I just came out of Terrace Creek and Bob's Creek, counting the little map on the river. I had about 15 minutes to eat and get here. Out of the elevators. We had a really good day. And it's your fault.
Your fault.
My fault that you're sampling?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. But isn't it so much fun?
All right, yeah, thanks, really guys.
Is it your first time? Is it your first time?
No.